So like I often do, I'm going to start off with a question this morning, but I have to preface it with something. When I ask this question, please don't point to people next to you in the pew, okay? The question is, do you know people, do you know someone who is able to find the cloud in every silver lining? Do you know people who are able to find the bad in every situation, no matter how good it is? When I was in college, there was a Saturday Night Live skit with a character called Debbie Downer. Anybody remember Debbie Downer? It doesn't matter what they were doing. They could be at Disney World, and she could bring everyone down and quit from having a good time. The reason I bring that up is because last week in the message, we're in John, we're in chapter 11. We've been going through the whole book of John. And last week in chapter 11, we got to see the pinnacle of the miracles of Jesus. We got to see all the, John calls them signs. Jesus performs many signs throughout the book of John. And last week, we got to see the resurrection of Lazarus after he had been in the grave for 4 days. I want to remind you of that story and look at what we looked at last week in John chapter 11. Verses 38 through 44. Here's how it happened. It says, then Jesus, angry in himself again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Remove the stone, Jesus said. Martha, the dead man's sister, told him, Lord, he's already decaying. It's been 4 days. Jesus said to her, didn't I tell you that if you believe, you would see the glory of God? So they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you heard me. I know that you always hear me, but because of the crowd standing here, I said this, so they may believe you sent me. After he said this, he shouted with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, bound hand and foot with linen strips and with his face wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said to them, loose him and let him go. Now, we looked at that last week, and we saw that Jesus prays this whole prayer, and his purpose is what? I'm going to do this thing right here, Father, and I'm praying out loud, Father, so that those who are standing here may do what? Believe, so that they may believe that you sent me. And so this incredible thing happens, and then we go on to the next verse, verse 45, and it says, then everyone bowed down and worshiped Jesus and sang praises to him. That's not what the next couple verses say. The title of the message today is, how do you react to the power of Christ? How do you react to the power of Christ? I want to read you this passage for today. We're going to be looking at verses 45 through 53. John chapter 11, beginning in verse 45. Here's the reaction. Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees convened the Sanhedrin and said, what are we going to do since this man does many signs? If we let him continue in this way, everyone will believe in him. Then the Romans will come and remove both our place and our nation. One of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all. You're not considering that it is to your advantage that one man should die for the people rather than the whole nation perish. He did not say this on his own, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to unite the scattered children of God. So from that day on, they plotted to kill him. How do you react to the power of Christ? As we look at this passage, I want to think about four words. The first word is division. There's a division that takes place right off the beginning. The second word I want to look at is intimidation. The third word is manipulation. And finally, I want to look at sovereignty as we walk through this. And my hope is that as we look at how this transpires and how these things take place and people's reaction to Jesus, that all of us would consider fresh and new how we react to the power of Christ in our lives. So let's jump in. Let's look at the division that takes place. It begins by saying, therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he did believed in him. However, some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Some of the people react exactly the way we would expect. I mean, if you just saw someone command a person who had been dead for 4 days to come back to life, we would think, oh, everyone's going to believe in Jesus. And that was the reaction of some of them. Some of them believed in him and put their faith in him. But the shocking part is that some people went and tattled on Jesus. Now, we know from chapter 10 and the study we've done so far, the Pharisees are trying to kill Jesus. They've tried to stone him. They've tried to arrest him. So when those people go back and tell the Pharisees, they're not spreading the good news. They're going and saying, hey, Jesus is still doing these miracles. He's still doing this stuff. And look what he did now. Guess what he just did today. The truth is, because of our human and sinful reactions, the result of Jesus displaying his power is oftentimes division. Because of our sinfulness, it divides people when we see the incredible power of Jesus. Now, this shouldn't come as a shock to us because as we've studied John, every time, almost every time Jesus performs a miracle, he does a sign, what is there? There's division almost every time. If you're a note taker, I want to share with you a few passages. We're not going to read all these, but John chapter 5, verses 16 through 18. Chapter 6, verses 41 through 43. Chapter 6, verses 60 through 66. Pretty much all of chapter 7, there's three or four miracles in chapter 7, and they all result in division. And chapter 8, verse 48, this has been the norm. When Jesus does something incredible, people are divided. When he displays his power, people are divided. That's important for us to remember today because, brothers and sisters, as we go and we share the good news, the gospel, the power of Jesus Christ, it will cause division sometimes. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, it gives us some insight into why this is. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, beginning in verse 18, says, "For the message of the cross of Jesus Christ is foolishness to those who are perishing, but it is God's power to us who are being saved. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and I will set aside the understanding of the experts. Where is the philosopher? Where is the scholar? Where is the debater of this age? Hasn't God made the world's wisdom foolish? For since in God's wisdom the world did not know God through wisdom, God was pleased to save those who believe through the foolishness of our message, the message preached. For the Jews ask for a sign, and the Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. Yet to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is God's power and God's wisdom. Because God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength." We can't be surprised when we go preach the cross of Christ. It will divide. Some will understand and submit and put their very eternity in the power of Jesus Christ for resurrection. Others will find it utter foolishness. The same power, the same Jesus. It's just a different reaction. Jesus Christ himself warned us that this was going to be the case. And this would be the reaction to him coming. In the book of Matthew, chapter 10, Jesus says in verse 34, "Don't assume that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be the members of his household." Last night we had a meeting for Steel City Fellowship, and Harlan, who's preached for us here at the church before, Harlan brought a devotion to begin our meeting with, and he said something that cracked me up. He said, "When I read scripture, I have a tendency to find the nice Jesus and the tough Jesus." And in Matthew chapter 10, we have tough Jesus. We have Jesus saying, hey, guess what? When I come and display who I am and my power for the salvation of people, it will divide. It will divide people. Because some people don't want to accept, to submit to the power of Christ. So let's look at why that is. The next word that I want to talk about after division is intimidation. If we turn back to John chapter 11, verses 47 through 48, it says, "So the chief priests and the Pharisees convened the Sanhedrin and said, 'What are we going to do since this man does many signs? If we let him continue in this way, everyone will believe in him. Then the Romans will come and remove both our place and our nation.'" Many people react negatively to the truth and the power of Jesus Christ because it is a threat to their own power. They are intimidated. Now, here's what's amazing about this passage. Look again at their words in those verses. What are we going to do with this Jesus? He keeps performing miracles. Did they say he's a fake, he's a trickster, he's fooling everyone? What did they say? He keeps performing miracles. And if we let him keep performing miracles, everybody's going to believe in Jesus. There's that recognition that he is doing incredible things. And the natural reaction to those incredible things is to believe in Jesus. They recognize that with their own words. Now, here's what's funny about that. I've spent a lot of time in my life, especially when I was a youth pastor and when I first started seminary, just deep in apologetics, in being able to defend your faith in Christ in an argument. But you know what I've come to realize? I can give the best argument in the world. Jesus could stand in front of you and raise someone from the dead. But that's not enough. An argument, a debate, proof is not enough. There's something deep inside that has to happen. Because even though they admit he's doing signs and everybody's going to believe in them, what do they themselves do? They deny him, even in the midst of all this. Why do they deny him? Because of fear, because they're intimidated. What are they afraid of? They're afraid, first of all, of a lesser power. They say, if Jesus keeps doing these things, then the Romans are going to come in, and they're going to decimate Jerusalem, and they're going to destroy the temple, so we can't let Jesus continue. Are the Romans powerful? Yes, at this point in time, very powerful. Do they have something to fear from the Romans? Yes, 40 years after Jesus, the Romans come in and decimate Jerusalem and destroy the temple. They will do that. But are the Romans more powerful than God? No. They are blind to what Jesus is doing. They're turning away from Christ because they're afraid of a lesser power. Now, we might look at that and we might scoff and say, oh, you silly people. But how often do we do that exact same thing? How often are we blind to what Jesus is doing because we're afraid of a lesser power? We're afraid of maybe people who are an authority in our society. We're afraid of bosses. We're afraid of losing a position. We're afraid of a lesser power and what that power might do to us. And so we let that keep us from being obedient to Christ and following him. The second thing I think that they're afraid of that's intimidating them is that they fear the future. When they speak of our place or our holy place, there's two ideas to what that could mean. The first is that they're talking about the temple, that they're talking about our place will be destroyed, our holy temple will be destroyed. Now let me ask you, is the temple a good thing? And the answer is yes. How do we know that? Because where did the temple come from? Who told them to build altars and sacrifice animals and do all those things? Did they make that up themselves? God spoke from heaven to Moses. The temple's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with loving the temple. However, and listen to this carefully, we can never let our love for what God has done in the past blind us to what God is doing right now or what he has planned in the future. We can't be so in love with what God has done in the past that we're blind to what God has planned for the future. Brothers and sisters, in my 18 years of ministry in Pueblo now, I have seen many churches close their doors for this exact reason. We can never be so in love with what God's done in the past that we miss what he's doing in the future and what's going on right now. Last thing that I think they're intimidated by, that they're afraid of, and that's losing their own power. Now, I said when they say our holy place, it could mean two things. It could mean the temple, but it could also mean their priestly office, their authority, their position in society. If Jesus keeps doing these miracles, people will believe in him, and all of a sudden me, as the priest, nobody cares about me anymore. I've lost my place. I've lost my authority. I've lost my power. So in the end, they weren't concerned with right or wrong or truth or lies. They were only concerned with preserving their nation and their place within that nation. They were intimidated by the power of Jesus, that it might take away their power. And they missed what he was doing. And that brings us to the last point, or the third point, manipulation. Verses 49 and 50 say, one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all. You're not considering that it is to your advantage that one man should die for the people rather than the whole nation perish. Now, it's kind of funny, as I was studying his phrase and what he says, the audacity of Caiaphas, because he's standing, he's the high priest, but he's with the most powerful people in the Jewish nation at that point, and he tells them, you guys are idiots. That's basically what he says. What are you worried about? What are you scared about? What are you afraid of? And then he presents his argument, and his argument is really an argument we hear a lot today. It's what we would refer to as the end justifies the means, or what we refer to as the lesser of two evils. Basically, what he says is, yeah, Jesus is this guy that everybody's following, and he does these miracles and all these things, and he's innocent. But it's much better for one innocent man to die than for a whole nation to perish. The end justifies the means. All we have to do is get rid of this Jesus. And it's important enough to save the nation that even if it's wrong to get rid of Jesus, it's right in the end. The end justifies the means. Now, this represents a really common reaction to the power of Jesus, and that's manipulation. We realize when we see the power of Christ, we realize our powerlessness. We realize how much power we don't have. And so what we do is we begin to lie and cheat and steal, and we begin to throw good and right and wrong out the window and manipulate situations in order to gain our power back. But even this is a feeble attempt. And the reason it's a feeble attempt is because of our last word for today. And that's sovereignty. Verses 51 through 53 say, the chief priest Caiaphas, he did not say this on his own, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation. And not for the nation only, but also to unite the scattered children of God. So from that day on, they plotted to kill him. Man, I love the sovereignty of God in this passage. Think about what's transpiring. They're all gathered together, and they're conspiring to kill Jesus so that they can end his influence. And in the very midst of this evil meeting, God is in control and speaking through the high priest. In the midst of this evil meeting, God says, yeah, this is exact. I'm going to use this for my purpose. Why? Because I am sovereign. I'm sovereign over all of it. Jesus dying for the nation has been God's plan all along. In chapter 3, when we first began our study of John, verses 14 and 15, Jesus says, just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, so that everyone who believes in him will have eternal life. And then a little further in John chapter 10, again in verses 14 and 15, Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. I know my own sheep and they know me. As the Father knows me and I know the Father, I lay down my life for the sheep. You see, one very important lesson from this passage is that no matter how good or how evil our reaction to Christ's power is, God still stands sovereign. None of that changes his plan and his purpose. That's exactly what sovereignty means. He is always in control. So with that being said, I want to close today by looking very carefully at the commentary that John adds. John is telling the story, he's narrating, but then in verse 52, 51 and 52, he throws in his own comments. And he says, he did not say this on his own, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, verse 52, and not for the nation only, but also to unite the scattered children of God. The incredible news for us today, for those of us sitting here in this room, is that Jesus did not simply come to rescue the Jewish nation. Now, in John chapter 10 that we just read, verses 14 and 15, Jesus says, I'm the good shepherd. I lay down my life for the sheep in verse 15. And then what does he say in verse 16? But I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. Then there will be one flock and one shepherd. And we're going to get there in a couple weeks in John chapter 12. Jesus says this. In verse 32, as for me, if I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all people to myself. See, Jesus wasn't dying just for the nation. He was dying for all of God's children, no matter where or when they live. No matter where or when they live. And this includes me and you. Something beautiful, I can remember the first time I read this and realized it. And I grew up in church, and I know I had heard this passage so many times. But when I began reading through my Bible every year, I started doing that when I was 25, I think. I started reading through the Bible in a year, every year. And I can remember it was the first or second year of doing that I was reading through my Bible in a year, and I came to John chapter 17, and it blew my mind. Because in John chapter 17, we have the prayer of Jesus before he goes to the cross. Now that's got to be an incredibly powerful prayer, right? The Son of God before he goes to give himself for the world, the sins of the world. So Jesus begins in chapter 17 of John praying for himself and that God would work and fill him and use him. And then he prays for his disciples, that they'd be strengthened and encouraged and they would be his messengers. And then all of a sudden, something incredible happens in John chapter 17, verse 20. Jesus says, remember, this is the last thing he prays before he goes to the cross. I pray not only for my disciples, but also for those who will believe in me through their message. May they all be one, as you, Father, are in me and I am in you. May they also be one in us, so the world may believe that you sent me. When he says, I pray for all those who will believe in me because of the message of the disciples, who is he praying for? Me. Jesus, before he went to the cross, prayed for me. He prayed for us. Do you know what he prayed for in there? What did he pray for? That we would be one. That we would be one. That the children of God across all time and space would be united as one people. And then the world will know that Jesus Christ is the Messiah sent from the Father. So if you're here today and you're still battling with the truth of who Jesus Christ is, if you're still struggling with his power, I would submit to you, it's not because there's not great arguments out there. It's not because there's not convincing proof. If you believe anything in history, you have to believe the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. There's more recorded about that than anything else. I submit to you that it's still an issue of giving up your power to his. But it's so worth it. To release that, to let go, and say, you know what? I'm okay losing my place, my importance, my authority in order to be rescued from myself and the world I've created. And brothers and sisters, those of you who are here today who have put your faith in Christ, first and foremost, as we come today, we're going to celebrate communion together. And I want this to be a celebration. We are celebrating that we have been rescued, that we have been saved. But as we do that, I want each of us to search our hearts and search our lives and find the places where we were still intimidated, where we're still manipulating, where we're still divided on Christ and his purpose and his mission in our life. Because we each have those places in our lives, those places that we are intimidated by the power of Jesus and what he can do, and we manipulate things in order to remain in control of those areas of our life. And I want us each to search our hearts today as we partake of the bread and the cup. I want us to search our hearts, and I want us to turn those things over to him. To say, I give up. I give up my authority. I give up my power. I don't care if I lose my place, as long as you are in the proper place. I want to invite the deacons to come forward this morning.